For the week of December 21st, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 262, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Gills.
How is Birmingham, Michael?
It's just fine. We're all here for the holidays, all my family. And I know what Sony wants for the holidays.
So do I. They would like a time machine.
Yes. That's right.
We totally did not plan that.
Absolutely. They could go back to redo the disaster or not make the movie at all. Who knows? There's so many options, but a time machine would help.
Yeah, well, you know, when we decided that, you know, all of our listeners wrote in and said, well, not all of them, but many of them wrote in and said, hey, do a show Christmas week. We said, okay, we didn't think there'd be any news to cover. And little did we know that, heck, there's more news to cover now than there ever has been.
So what will we cover?
Well, of course, we'll talk about the only story that seems to matter here in the entertainment business these days, and that's the hack against Sony Pictures Entertainment, which we were just referencing. The news is changing fast and furiously. First, North Korea was behind the attack, and then they weren't, and now they are again. First, Sony said they would still release The Interview, the movie that supposedly got these hackers up in arms. They were going to release it on Christmas Day, then they canceled their opening, but now it's back on again. Maybe we'll explain. Ferris Bueller's hooky hijinks will now be immortalized forever in the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress. Don't worry, he won't be alone. He can hang out with the dude from The Big Lebowski, and they can both go save Private Ryan so they can all help raise Rosemary's Baby.
Okay.
Yeah, you see what I did there? Hey, I only included like four or five films, so...
Keep going.
Okay, well, Michael, you remember the difference between performance rights and mechanical rights when it comes to recorded music? Yeah, well, neither do most people, by the way, but music industry tycoon Irving Azoff is trying to make sure YouTube understands them perfectly. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about box office around the world, not just North America. We're looking at every box office in every country. We pull our information from Rentrack. We have a link in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Mojo and Box Office Profit and Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, anywhere we can pull info on box office around the world. And when you pull it all together, it's clear that the number one movie around the world is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, the finale to this three-part trilogy of The Hobbit. $161 million this weekend, $355 million worldwide. A big, huge, successful finale for the Hobbit movies.
I didn't look it up, but is that the fastest any movie has gotten to $355 million worldwide? Probably not, because of Iron Man 3.
I don't think it's close, yeah. It's doing very well, but it's not setting records in that way. It's setting personal best for the Hobbit movies, but not overall.
Well, I mean, I think in the U.S. it opened lower than some of the other movies.
Well, it was a Wednesday opening versus a Friday opening. You know, that's why we always say, hey, look at the budget, look at the final numbers, and then talk about, you know, what you should say as far as how successful it is. Because there are a lot of factors that go into how quickly it opens, how strongly it has legs, how well it closes. You know, it's at $355 million. It's going to hit close to $1 billion. They're going to be just fine. And number two around the world is Gone with the Bullets. This is a Chinese satire. It's set during the 20s in Shanghai, between the wars, and it's set with the backdrop of a beauty pageant. And it grossed $36 million this weekend, and it's at $50 million and counting. It only opened up in China, so that is tearing it up on the Chinese box office.
Well, that's because it only opened up in China because North Korea hacked in and made sure it didn't leave the country.
So it is co-written, directed, and starring Jiang Wen, who was an actor. He was in Red Sorghum, among some other major films. And as a director, he made a movie I really love called Devils on the Doorstep that I saw at Cannes a few years ago. So, you know, he's having a big commercial success here. At number three around the world is Night at the Museum, The Secret of the Tomb. Is that what it's called?
I think so,
yes. The third and final, undoubtedly, Night at the Museum movie. It made $28 million. A good chunk in North America, where it opened a little low and a little bit more overseas, is not as successful. Third film in the franchise, a little tired. They were pushing it with two, and that's what happens when you make three in a series that doesn't really deserve it.
Well, I can tell you about another film a little bit lower down on your list. Well, you know, why don't you get to the next couple films? Then when you get to number six, call me.
All right. And number four is PK. This is an Indian comedy, a Bollywood comedy, a Hindi film, I should say. It grossed $25 million. It opened in 22 territories. It's about an alien who comes down to Earth, and winds up, he's naked, and he has to find his way and get home again. But he's an adult man. He has fun. He looks like an adult human. He has fun. He falls in love. And he also exposes the corruption of some, what are they called? They're called godmen. They're sort of the Indian equivalent of televangelists. And there are a lot of fakers out there. And he exposes some as fakes. And so it's all a light comedy. Falls in love with a girl, blah, blah, blah. Stars superstar Aamir Khan. And it's a big hit film. And one of the fun things about this movie is that it grossed $3.5 million in North America. So talk about a movie opening worldwide. This one did open up in a lot of territories, not just India, and it included the U.S., where it hit the charts. It's number 10. The 10th highest grossing film in North America this weekend was PK, a movie on 272 screens. It grossed $12,000 per screen. A lot of people who love these movies turned out to see this film and got it into the top 10. Is this the first time? I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw an Indian film break into the U.S. top 10. And this is one of the biggest times of the year. It's not like it's happening in the dog days of March or February.
Which some people would point out is maybe a comment on
the growing population in North America and the growing number of screens that show these movies. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I would say it is. But some people would say, well, that's because Hollywood movies are so bad that everybody's going to see other movies. No, I think it's exactly what you said. It's a growing population of immigrants from India
and people who cross over, people who like these movies, well-made movies, big stars, or other people who go to see them as well.
Yes,
so it's a very healthy sign. And number five is Penguins of Madagascar, grossed $20 million. It's passing the $200 million mark. And then there's the movie Sperling wants to talk about, Adorable Annie, the little plucky orphan. It grossed $17 million, almost all of it in North America, where it went sort of back and forth between this movie and Night at the Museum to see which would be number two behind The Hobbit.
Well, I can tell you, and the reason I wanted to talk about this in regards to Night at the Museum is because, you know, my kids have been dying to see Annie. That's all. They see the posters. They love the trailer. They wanted to see the movie with the Annie with the big hair.
Are they singing the song? The sun will come out tomorrow.
They like Hard Knock Life a little better.
Oh, little Jay-Z fans. Okay.
Yeah. And they were, you know, they still want to see it. However, because this movie received such horrible reviews, grandparents and most parents don't want to go see it and instead are actually going, you know what? We got to take them to the movies because they can't. Let's take them to see Night at the Museum. At least that one doesn't look so bad.
Well, Night at the Museum did poorly. So don't make it feel like a big chunk of the audience for Annie flocked to Night at the Museum. That movie had a pretty weak opening.
No. What I'm saying is I think that the poor reviews for Annie are doing it some serious damage, which I know. Well, I mean, that might be self-evident, but in this case, there is an alternative. And at least with Night at the Museum, parents and grandparents kind of know what they're getting into.
Yes. Another bad movie.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't understand why. Well, we don't want to see this movie, bad movie, so we'll go see this other bad movie. Why not rent a video? So, yeah, they did not do well. Annie had a 29% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that that is the beginning and end. Night at the Museum had a 48%, which is still an awful rating, but twice as good as Annie. But those are really bad ratings. Those are below 50%. You're a very poorly reviewed movie.
Where is Paddington on this list?
Well, it hasn't opened in North America yet, so it's not on here.
Okay, fine.
But again, that's, you know, a very rough, broad idea. But they both got very bad reviews. I don't think either one is doing great. Annie only cost $65 million, so that one will hopefully at the end be profitable for that studio, which is Sony. They could use some good news. Right below them is another studio that doesn't need any good news. It's Lionsgate.
Yes.
They have The Hunger Games, Mockingjay, Part 1, huge success story. That's at $640 million. But right below that is another troubled film, and that is Exodus, Gods and Kings. It's sort of a remake of The Ten Commandments, the story of Moses. It stars Christian Bale. It grossed $15 million this weekend. It passed the $100 million mark worldwide. But this movie has fallen hard and fast in North America. It is at number four, you know, and it's only made $40 million in the U.S. It's not going to come anywhere near the budget of $140 million. It needs to not double its money overseas. It needs to, like, 10 times, make 10 times as much money overseas as it did in North America just to break even, really.
Well, do you think it has a chance of doing that?
Well, I don't know the territories that are left. I don't know if you do. I don't know how many big territories it has, how it's tracking there. It's made $61 million overseas. Where it will end up, I don't know. It's in 38 territories. Does it have China and Japan to come? I think it has not opened in China, but it just depends on how many big territories it has yet to open in. But I would, it's not looking great. That's
no,
for sure.
That's for sure. Yeah. Well, that you mean that both literally and figuratively.
Another movie that's a little bit in trouble is Big Hero 6.
Wait, how is that movie in trouble? Can't it save itself?
It is
a health robot. You know, it's about a health robot.
Well, it's a little sickly at the box office. It's a well-reviewed Disney film. It cost $160 million to make. Animated films are very expensive. This movie grossed $15 million over the weekend. It's at $275 million worldwide. It probably needs to double that.
What?
Well, it needs to get to at least $480, $500 million, right? It cost $160 million to make.
I think that if they can break even box office-wise.
Well, they need to. That's our rule of thumb is roughly triple their budget.
Triple the budget.
That's $480 million worldwide. You only get back a third overseas.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, I know that at least when it comes to DVD...
That's just for us to know that it's a very profitable, solidly profitable film. We can't look at the books. So if we're going to say, yeah, this movie was a success story, it doesn't mean it lost money. It just means you triple your budget based on, you know, how much you spent on it and how much you spend on advertising and so on. You know, if you triple your budget for a big Hollywood studio film, chances are you're probably going to be just fine.
Well, we can't look at the books right now, but North Korea, work on that, would you? Disney.
We're not supposed to be making jokes anymore. We've moved beyond that. It's very ugly now.
I know.
And number 10 is Paddington, the family film you were wondering about. This has been well-reviewed. Even though it looked god-awful in the early trailers, it grossed $10 million over the weekend. It's at $60 million worldwide. And number 11 is Ode to My Father, a South Korean drama. It's a tearjerker. It travels through 60 years of South Korean history, beginning with the Korean War and a family who are refugees, and the son is separated from his father and becomes the sole responsibility for his family. He's the one who's going to oversee everybody and make sure they're okay, and he spends the next 60 years keeping that pledge, and we see all of Korean history through his eyes. That's what the movie's about. Sounds like a tearjerker, a lovely film. It grossed $10 million and had a solid start. Another movie doing very well in South Korea is My Love, Don't Cross the River. That's the documentary film we talked about the adorable elderly couple who've been together for like 70 years, and now one of them is dying. They made a documentary film about them. First, it was a special on TV. Now it's been turned into a feature-length documentary released in theaters. It grossed $6 million over the weekend. It's made $14 million so far in South Korea alone. I have no idea, but I assume it's, if not the highest grossing documentary film in South Korean history, certainly one of them. It would be one of the highest grossing in North America if it had opened up here. I mean, this is a ton of money for a documentary film. I'm intrigued. I can't wait to see it.
Well, I noticed you skipped over Interstellar.
Well, I didn't skip over it. I just thought I would stick to the South Korea for a second. And there at number 12 is Interstellar, $635 million worldwide. That's the box office.
Okay. Well, you started there with South Korea. I see what you wanted to do there. I think maybe you wanted to head a little further north from South Korea to North Korea so that we could talk about the Sony hacks. Was that the plan?
That was the idea, Sperling, and you messed it up.
I'm sorry. My apologies. Well, you know, speaking of messing up, I mean, here we were last week, we were putting the show together, and I had all these jokes in the intro, right? Like, one joke out, we're reading Amy Pascal's email, where we had all these funny jokes, and we get on the line, and you said, look, you got to erase all those. You can't have those jokes because, you know...
They're threatening to kill people.
They're threatening to kill people now.
They're evoking 9/11.
You just kind of told me that you received the email from the hackers that said, you know, all the 9/11 stuff. You can't joke about it now. And now it's serious. And that was, within like 10 minutes of me receiving this email, the one that kind of set off the whole storm of, oh, this must be North Korea, because it was the first time that the interview was actually mentioned in any of their threats.
That's right. Where do we start with this mess? Let's start with a little sympathy for Sony.
Okay. I think Sony's getting a lot of sympathy these days.
No, they're not. They're getting pilloried left and right. People are saying that Pascal Linton will be fired at some point. the Japanese don't like to act quickly. They don't want to look like they're acting under pressure. And in a year or two, they'll probably be eased out of their roles. People are questioning them. Why did they make the movie? Why did they make it a name? Why didn't they disguise the name of the dictator? Why did they back down from the terrorists? The president is calling them out. Everybody's criticizing and attacking them. I feel like other movies were made that made fun of this dictator, or his father, I should say, made fun of the leader of this country.
Although it was pointed out that the leader never was killed. Kim Jong-il.
I didn't say he was killed, but he was mocked mercilessly.
Yes.
Very amusingly, Team America. So, okay. People said they should have known never to make this movie in the first place. It wouldn't have occurred to me that they would launch a cyber attack against the U.S. and, you know, threaten to blow theaters up. That would not have occurred to me. It clearly didn't occur to them. There's the possibility that the corporate office in Japan said, you're yanking this film. Even though they signed off on the film and were involved in it, you know, whatever concerns they had, they signed off on it too. But maybe they said, pull this movie from the theaters, and now Linton and Pascal have to fall on their swords and take the heat for it, even though it wasn't their call. Perhaps it wasn't. We don't know, right? But I just feel sympathy for them. There was no good, even though they messed up PR-wise, said some things in the wrong way, got in pissing contests with other people, had all this embarrassing stuff going on. I think, number one, I don't think it was clear that making this film would somehow create an international incident. I think number two, that I think virtually any company, 99% of all companies, will be just as vulnerable to this attack and will be for quite a while to come. The internet is an open system. We are all not built to be fortresses. That's not how the internet works. There isn't a company out there, I don't think, vast majority of them, that couldn't have been attacked by a government that was that mercilessly focused on destroying them that could not create a massive havoc. I mean, we see credit card and things stolen every day from big companies. Don't tell me that there are a lot of companies that somehow Sony is more vulnerable than IBM or General Motors or anybody you want to name. I think any company in any country has to be worried about this, and it's going to be a long time before they're prepared for it.
Well, a couple points there. First of all, any company with a computer is susceptible to being hacked, right?
I mean, sure, of course, but I don't think that Sony is somehow, you know, what were you thinking? Why weren't you prepared? You should have known this could happen. I think vast majority of businesses are very vulnerable because this is not the world that we lived in before today. And now they have to worry about this. And it's not natural for the way the internet works. It's not natural for business to behave like a bunker. And that's just not how they, you know, are set up to behave. And they need to rethink everything. It's going to be very hard to change how we behave and how we do business and how we deal with the internet to somehow make yourself more vulnerable. And I still think big governments from overseas that target you, if that's what they want to do, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Well, I guess, you know, we should probably backtrack a bit. But before we do, I just want to address that for a second. When you look at some of those other hacks, whether it be Home Depot or Target or any
but
of that.
Those were criminals or goofs.
Right.
I'm talking about none of these people were targeted by a government.
Well, but let me just continue here. When you look at those, okay, you're looking at there's a severity. And when you say somebody's more susceptible or not, okay, that's one thing. But then there's the way in which they set their networks up. With Sony, everything was in one place, meaning their data center was in one place. All of their data was in one place. When you look and you listen and you start reading between the lines of some of these hacks, it's, oh, Home Depot was hacked and they got credit card numbers, but they can't put those numbers with any actual people because that information was somewhere else. Or they got passwords, but they were hashed and salted, meaning, okay, they got a bunch of gibberish. And yes, they have the password data, but it doesn't mean anything to them. That's what I mean. It's like the way Sony was set up wasn't very secure. So while everybody
Home Depot is remarkably better set up security-wise on cyber attacks than Sony from a government?
I think retailers in general are because of the way they have to set up their networks to be compliant with certain credit card companies.
I don't think so. I would think if a government targeted them and wanted to do serious damage to a Home Depot or Walmart, that they could do incredible damage. I don't think either of them. You know, if you wanted to go in and destroy data and mess up their business, I think you could do it and steal emails and get all that stuff out there. You're talking about something separate, stealing credit card information in order to commit a crime. When your job is only to destroy them and create havoc, you don't care about credit card information. You're copying emails. You're telling me emails are as secure as credit card info? I bet they're not.
Oh, no.
Right.
Emails
so if you
are...
wanted the emails of Home Depot, I bet you could have them from the CEO on down. They wouldn't be juicy and make headline news about talking about Angelina Jolie. But if what you wanted to do was what they did to Sony, I'm sure Home Depot and Walmart and Kmart and General Motors and all these other people would be just as vulnerable. I don't think for a second that they're somehow, oh, we're so savvy. We've got all our stuff on different servers and we're really prepared. No, this is a new world. People do not, internet's not set up that way. Businesses are not set up that way. There's no bunker mentality like we have to be prepared for attack. As there didn't need to be. And so anybody who looks at Sony and laughs and thinks, haha, you were lazy and dumb. I don't think so. But am I wrong?
I think in part, I think the way Sony was set up, they may not have been lazy and dumb. They may have been naive. And what I mean by that is everything was in one place. When it comes to that kind of network management, you'd never put all your data in one place, ever. That said, why don't we backtrack a bit and go over. So last week, we kind of brought you up to speed as to where things were. It was a lot of email conversation, a lot of the whole Amy Pascal.
That was
Scott,
100 years ago.
In this story, it really does feel like 100 years ago. You're absolutely right. Now, we talked about Amy Pascal's joking with Scott Rudin about going to see the...
Or as others put it, her racist comments.
Right. And Scott Rudin's racist... Well, I guess Scott Rudin wasn't really commenting.
No, he was too. Absolutely.
John Singleton, a filmmaker and producer, probably best...
worked with them and they helped, you know, he's worked with both of them closely throughout his career, and they've all had a great relationship. So he's a friend of theirs.
Yeah.
At least professionally.
Yes. And he actually talks about, you know, Amy Pascal and Scott Rudin not being racist, not for their comments, but about their actions.
That's right. He says, look, I didn't read those emails the same way some other people have. But no matter what you feel about private comments they made off the cuff to somebody else in a private conversation, is that how we want to judge people's entire career? He says, I've dealt with them. They've been great with me. I've watched Amy Pascal hire black people. I've watched her be proactive, looking at her entire career and what she has done as a figure. I'd rather look at that and in context, put whatever you think about these emails, put it in the context of all of that, that she has been proactive, hired people, not just brought a token person on board, but hired people who are qualified and given them the opportunity to succeed and grow and, you know, reach their expectations. So, I think it's a reasonable comment to make. It is important, you know, you don't want to diss somebody for one offhand mistake. You want to look at their entire career. You know, if one woman accuses Bill Cosby of rape, you go, well, gee, I don't know. When 15 of them do, then you have to give it a new thought. You know, if Amy Pascal every week is doing some new horrible thing like, say, Mel Gibson did, where it wasn't one offhand comment, it was repeated comments over the years and repeated actions, then at some point you go, you know what, I've had enough.
Well, it was repeated actions even after his previous actions were known publicly. He continued.
Right, of course. So I'm just saying this doesn't mean Amy Pascal and Scott Rudin get a pass because one black man stood up for them. But I think he makes an interesting point of, hey, let's at least put it in perspective. And how did they behave publicly? What did they say? What did they do? What were their actions? And what were their hiring practices? Because that's what he says will make the real change in Hollywood, bringing more people of color into the infrastructure of the studios and behind the cameras and on the set.
Well, it was a very well-written piece and worth reading.
Well, it repeats sort of what we felt initially about those comments, that they were embarrassing, but we didn't see them as racist, but we're not black. And many black people did. And many people who are more sensitive, perhaps, on race issues than we are saw it that way and were very upset. And you know what? She doesn't get a pass because of this. She's still doing all the work she needs to do to try and repair those bridges.
Now, so last week we talked about that. We talked about what, you know,
let's talk about this week.
Yeah, the speculation. Well, I'm trying to bring us up to this week, which is, we kind of ended the show, and moments later, Sony said, look, if theaters don't want to play this film, we'll leave it up to the theaters. They've booked the film. If they don't want to show it, it's up to them. We'll let them out of the booking contract. Well, it didn't take long before Carmike Cinemas, which is like the fourth or fifth largest chain in the country, the United States and Canada, North America, and they said, no, we're not going to, we're pulling it. Well, by the following morning, all of a sudden, you had AMC, Cinemark, and Regal Entertainment, the top three cinema chains, saying, guess what? We're pulling it, too. We're not going to show it on Christmas Day either. Well, Sony then had no choice.
God, that is not how to describe this. And I can't believe you, Mr. Back Pocket of the distribution people, would think that way.
Well, that makes me sound like I work for a distributor. I'm saying you know their point of view
and you know you empathize with their attitude on a lot of things. You know well how they think. And I think that description is exactly what Sony would like, but it's not fair or true.
Well,
Sony
here's,
just as NATO said, well, we can't decide for them. Well, of course you can't. You have no power to decide for individual theater chains. It's not your purview. But they said they'll have to make up their own decision. Well, thank you, NATO. We do that. And then Sony said, well, we won't decide, but do you guys want to show a movie on Christmas Day and have the theaters blow up and kill people? Because we know the mall is calling you and yelling, people won't go shopping if they're worried about bombs. We know the other studios are calling you and yelling, saying, hey, I want people to go see Into the Woods and Unbroken and all these other films. Are you going to show this movie and people are going to stay away from our movie because the other film might attract bombing? So everybody's yelling at them and they felt they had no choice. They couldn't safely show the movie on Christmas Day and not risk the holiday season and the lives of the theater goers. And they started to say, well, I guess we won't. And then Sony said, oh, see, we had no choice.
Okay, now a couple of points there. Mm-hmm. Now, Sony very well may have set the movie theaters up and probably did set the movie theaters up to take the fall on that. I don't disagree with you there, okay? And they did so purposefully knowing how the theaters would react.
Right.
They said, we're going to let you out of this, so it's not on us. It's your decision. Now, we all know what decision you're going to make.
And it's the same decision we want you to make and everybody else wants you to make.
And here's why. Because at that point, they knew the top four or five theater chains, which account for between 60 and 70% of their box office take in North America only. They knew that they would pull out. And once that happened, there was no way for this movie to be successful theatrically.
However, for that particular date.
However, I will counter, the other studios were not calling Sony, and here's why.
Not Sony, they were calling the theater chains. They were worried and upset that their movies would have their box office affected because, you know, hey, what do you do? What are you making this up? We don't want people to stay away from our movie because they're scared about the other movie.
Studios, and this is kind of a big misconception, studios are not allowed to talk to one another about this kind of activity, not without a whole lot of lawyers. So, yeah, that's kind of an antitrust collusion issue since there's only six studios,
studios. This is why I feel bad for Sony, because then Obama, I don't know why he decided to weigh in on this, but he said he was sorry that they did that. And some people said, oh, we're not prepared for cyber attacks, and therefore he wants to divert attention from the fact that the U.S. is vulnerable, as if somehow the president could wave a wand to make every business behave responsibly or create new bunkers of security. So it's not really his fault. It's a huge national security issue, but it's a very difficult problem to tackle. But anyway, people thought maybe he wants to divert attention from the fact that we got cyber attacked, so he's going to blame Sony. And other people say, well, you know, he's a constitutional scholar. He may be just reacting viscerally like I did to this First Amendment issue and saying, golly, seems like a bad idea to cave to terrorists and let them dictate what movies we show.
That's right. So, in fact, the very day this happened, when Sony, because what happened was the theater chain said, we're not showing it. Sony said, okay, that's it. We're pulling the movie. We're not going to open it Christmas Day. And they didn't say what they were going to do.
They did. They said, we have no plans to show this movie. And the people came back to him and said, Hollywood Reporter and others, oh, what about a video on demand? No. We have no plans. Nothing. They made it sound like they were going to bury this film in a deep, dark hole, and we were never going to see it again. Then 2 days later, they said, we never said we wouldn't release it in any way, shape, or form. We're thinking about other stuff. I mean, just...
Well, two days later, the president, as you say, president of the United States, actually spoke. Now, as you and kind of called them out on it, as you said, the very day that they pulled the film, you said, great, now anytime someone doesn't like a movie, they can threaten to blow up a theater. Where's NATO on this? The response is not to run in fear and do as they're told. The response is to take reasonable steps to ensure the safety of theater goers. Yes, true. Now, a couple of things. A lot of people are saying, and Aaron Sorkin among them, this was weak on the theater's part, weak on Sony. He's basically pointing fingers all over the place.
A pox on all of you.
Yeah, and saying, look, this is going to cause a chilling effect. But as you pointed out earlier, a lot of people are also saying, a lot of insiders are saying, well, why did they make this, the public more so on this latter comment? Why did they bother to make this film at all? Why did they have to name the dictator in the film? Well, that's also a chilling effect. If you fear...
Yeah. You're not supposed to make a drama about North Korea. You're not supposed to, about people escaping North Korea. You're not supposed to make documentary films about them. Plus, they knew that the hackers had more documents to release. And so they were putting themselves in a forever bind of never being able to say anything negative about North Korea in any film, because they would then release more documents. They'd have to say, uh-oh, we're being held hostage.
Well, that's true. And what would have happened in the lawsuits, which, as you see, Michael, are piling up faster than you can count them. Mm-hmm. Lawyers would have said, the plaintiffs would have said, so you knew that if you didn't change the release date or pull a particular release, that this data would have, more data would have been released, and yet you still didn't change anything? I mean, then all of a sudden you're culpable or
liable.
Right, exactly.
Again, my sympathy for Sony, they're in a rock and a hard place. If they release the movie, they get more attacks and their stock drops further, and they get blamed for that. If they don't release the movie, they get blamed for caving into terrorists.
Yeah, I mean,
what the problem was with them, nuance and wording and trying to go back on, you've got the head of Sony saying one thing and you've got their lawyer on CNN saying something entirely different.
David Boies is kind of a gun for hire. He comes in when things get messy and you need somebody. He did the Prop 8 case here in the United States for
He's representing them and he's on CNN saying, oh, we plan to release this film.
Well,
the head of Sony was saying, no, we don't know.
No, that was Sunday. He said that on Sunday. Well, technically, it was Friday because that was when that interview was recorded. But
it's a mess. It's a big, fat mess.
What I love is, so on Friday, Barack Obama gives his monthly press conference there. And, of course, he's asked about this. And as you say, he references it and he says, well, I wish Sony would have called me before they pulled the plug on it because, First Amendment and all that stuff. Now, it just goes to show you how the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing, because Michael Linton later in the day said, well, we were talking to advisors.
But that
to the
was
president.
Before. That was before. That was before. So that was not an out. He then implied, yeah, that got him into further trouble.
Oh,
because
okay.
When they spoke. Yeah, no, that didn't help him out. He looks even worse now. Like he's trying to, split hairs with the president. That didn't help him.
Part of that whole president thing was that that he had to mention Seth Rogen, and that he mentioned James Franco, but called him James Flacco.
Flacco
or some other name. And I just thought, wow, everybody says James Franco is overexposed. Like, please go away to an island and don't come back for like a decade. Then we can have your comeback.
I don't say that.
And here, the guy is the leader of the country, and he doesn't even know the guy's name. It was just a verbal slip, and I'm sure it was just a verbal slip.
Or he just hangs out with John Travolta a lot.
I don't know. It's just like, yeah, exactly. Ooh, there's a reference for you. Go back in time on that one.
Yeah. Well, here's how very wrong I was. When they announced, we will attack you 9/11, we will blow up your theaters, I absolutely thought, and I probably said on the show, well, this changes everything. There's going to be a rallying cry. People are going to say, wait a second, what? You're telling us what movies we can show? No way. I thought the studios would rally. I thought the theater chains would rally. I thought moviegoers would rally. This movie become a cause celeb. I don't mean to be a big hit, but people are like, you're not going to tell me I can't go to that movie. And I thought it would really, change the demeanor and what was going on with this crisis and have everybody pull back from the sniping and go, well, wait a second. Now somebody from the outside is really attacking us and our country and our way of life. We're not going to stand for this. And the opposite happened. The criticizing and the finger pointing and the name calling just increased exponentially.
Well, I think you're right, though. I'm going to back you up here. And I think the American public...
You're right that I was wrong.
No. I think that you're right that it did become a rallying cry for the public at large.
Uh-huh.
And I think the public said, yes, we're all going to go. I didn't plan on seeing that movie, but I'm going to see it now. I might buy a ticket and not even go. I might buy two tickets, one for me and one for I don't know who. I'll give it to somebody. I think you're absolutely right that for the public, it became a rallying cry. Then the realities of business set in. And once it became once threats were made, all of a sudden there's all these liability issues that go through the theaters all the way up to Sony. And, Obama actually talked about that. He said he knew that Sony was an organization, that these theaters were organizations, and that they have issues of liability. But it does set a horrible precedent.
You just take a pause. You take a breath. So we have no plans at this time. We're reconsidering. The important is that we have a safe holiday season and that our movies and other competitors' movies can enjoy themselves. And we'll readdress this at some later date. And then you plan something modest in February or March, or you do video on demand, or you do whatever you want. But to say, no, we're all done, and to make it sound like you're caving and you can never show it again or you're going to get more attacks was just the wrong tone to set.
Do you know what I think? If it was really North Korea, and we'll get into whether it was or wasn't briefly for just a moment, But let me give you what I think should happen with this movie, and it's not going to.
Well, it's going to happen. Well, two things are happening we should make clear. It's being released to two art houses. A number of theaters came forth and said, you know, tiny art houses, and said, hey, we'll show it. You know, and two of them are have booked it. It's going to be shown on Christmas Day. One is the Alamo Draft House in
is that Dallas. Dallas. Or Austin or something like
Austin.
That.
Austin. No, well, those are different places. It's a Dallas-Fort Worth region. That's right. And the other one is in Atlanta. And they said they're going to show it. They were going to show Team America as sort of a symbolic protest. Now they're going to screen those movies. And there's a potential it'll be released some way on video on demand on Christmas Day as well.
Well, you know, first of all, a couple of theater chains said that they would show, as you said, they were going to show Team America, and that was the Alamo Drafthouse folks. And Paramount said, no, you're not. Actually, you're not going to do that. So Paramount squashed that idea. And George R.R. Martin owns a movie theater, an independent movie theater, and said, hey, you know what? You could have called me. I would have shown it. What I would have said is, dude, aren't you supposed to be writing a book? Come on. You own right. a movie theater and you're worried about the interview? Please.
So two theaters on Christmas Day is not exactly a wide release for a big budget, decent budget R-rated comedy.
Here's what I think should have happened. I think if the whole North Korea thing was accurate, and we'll get into that in a second, as I mentioned, I think the United States should have seized the theatrical release, the first run theatrical rights to The Interview by eminent domain, which is a law in the United States where you can, if it's for the public good, you can go and seize property.
Who should have done this?
The United States. Just follow me here, okay? They could have seized the first run theatrical rights through eminent domain, released it on New Year's Day, not Christmas Day, and then basically given, you know, all the other rights would have been Sony's. So any proceeds would have gone to help the people who affected by the hack and or...
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
What do you mean? They could have easily...
The federal government should seize the film. Oh, we're worried about First Amendment rights. We will now seize your privately made film and release it and decide who gets the money.
But wait a second. Eminent domain is specific to private property. So yes, this would be
that's
commercial
that's
property.
That's just silly.
Well, but if you really care about the First Amendment, prove as a country you're not going to.
No, if you care about it, you encourage people to release films when they want to and how they want to, not seize it by the government and decide when they're going to release
it.
That
said,
I'm
not an eminent domain lawyer. I don't know how.
That's just the silliest thing I've ever heard. All right. You've been saying for a few days now that there are a number of reasons why you think security people are not convinced that the government actually has enough facts to say that North Korea is responsible for this. And in fact, at one point, North Korea did say, hey, we'll help you investigate, which people took as just sort of a joke. But they said, we didn't do it. We'll help you investigate. And now we know that the internet in North Korea has gone out and some people are questioning whether the United States did react and cause that internet outage in North Korea. It's like the entire country, which I mean probably includes about four people with internet access.
I was going to say there's only four access points going into North Korea, all through China. China easily could have turned those off. North Korea themselves could have said, you know what? We're actually concerned that we're going to be hacked since the U.S. keeps making these threats about responding in a proportional manner and a time and place of their choosing. You know what? Sounds like they're going to do it soon. Let's turn off the internet. So please
tell us, why do security experts think that all the facts are not in place yet?
Because when it comes to cyber attacks and hacking, attribution is one of the hardest things to do.
Figuring out who did it.
Yes, proving who did it is one of, even Stuxnet, okay? Stuxnet is the whole, Iranian centrifuge nuclear program hack where the centrifuge is overspun and it set the Iranian nuclear program back 5 years. People say, well, it was the U.S. and Israel. They can't prove it, and it's pointing more and more toward
because
those
people don't
two.
Have the access of governments to do that. Right. It's one thing for an individual outsider to say we don't have proof. It's another thing for a government to say they have proof.
Right.
Clearly, they have a lot more resources and ability to investigate such things.
Well, that said, if you wanted a copy of Stuxnet, you could get it. It's now out in the open, much like the hack that affected Sony Pictures. That hack was out in the open, according to what the government, the FBI, and government officials are saying, and the security officials that Sony hired. What they're saying is this attack mirrors an attack a year prior, which was linked to North Korea. So earlier, like in 2012 or 13, North Korea hacked some South Korean banks. They hacked a Syrian or Saudi Arabian oil company. All of those hacks, including the Sony hack, they all have identical code.
Okay. So, and you're saying, well, hey, that code is available. But once you do a hack and the code gets out in the open, anyone could grab that code and repurpose it to attack someone else.
That's right. If I was going to rob a bank, I might use the car of a previous bank robber. That way, nobody sees that it's me instead of the bank robber they already suspect. As well, the media, and I think this is where, did you notice the tone in the media shifted pretty dramatically? It went from, you know, this kind of like voyeuristic Schadenfreude story to, this is a terrorist attack or activity.
Of course, yeah.
Are we culpable? Not culpable, but we don't look too good by laughing at it for the past 2-3 weeks.
Well, that's when it was silly. Now they're changing their tone, of course.
Yeah. That said, the question is, did the media kind of point at North Korea?
No. Focus on what other reasons security experts think that the case has not been made yet.
This is the point that the media and numerous officials were quoted in the media saying, we think it's North Korea. So the hackers themselves said, perfect cover. We'll just say North Korea. The first time the interview was ever mentioned in any of the public emails and the emails that were sent to journalists such as us, Michael, was that last email. That is also conveniently.
But earlier ones made allusions. Nobody was wondering what it was about. We all thought it was about the interview. It wasn't like it was, you know, if you don't want to you say, hi, this is North Korea, we're attacking you, I'm pretty sure you're going to keep it vague. You know, I don't find that very telling. Okay, what else?
The way the FBI kind of released evidence. Now, some evidence they rightfully and properly held back. They said, look, there's some evidence we can't share. Why? Mm-hmm. Because if we share it, North Korea will know how we're hacking them. Okay, so we get that. And that's something that they should be saying, and it's something that you would say if you actually had figured it out. But the way they kind of talked about the evidence they did know kind of left a lot of room for reasonable doubt, way too much room. And when you look at all of the major hacks and security crimes that have occurred, cybersecurity crimes that have occurred over the past, I don't know, let's just take 5 years, you've got Snowden, you've got the Stuxnet, you've got some of these other hacks, and you look at the way this attack was set up, the way the malware was set up inside Sony, the usernames and passwords were hard-coded.
You're saying it's an inside job.
I'm saying that in part, it's an inside job. All Stuxnet, all of these big cyber crimes usually entail an inside person or some type of social engineering where it's the simplest thing, you know, had its Ducks network, somebody went with the malware and on a thumb drive and put it into a computer inside one of the nuclear facilities. There was no hacking involved. It was social engineering. And I believe that, is it North Korea? I don't know, okay? I can't say for sure. Nobody will, you know, it'll be years if anybody ever knows, okay? But I believe whoever perpetrated this did have some inside help that does not rule out North Korea at all. North Korea very well may have turned to a current or former Sony employee and said, hey, we'll pay you a lot of money to give us some information that will allow us to hack into that network even easier than if we had to do it.
I bow to your inside knowledge on technology and the internet and security, et cetera, as far as not being able to actually pin. You don't feel like there's been enough evidence released for you to judge to say that this is clearly
North
Korea.
And there may never be.
But what I don't understand is why you would think the U.S. government would jump to the conclusion. They have no possible motive for saying North Korea is responsible for this attack. If they could slough it off and say, you know, we look like it's anonymous hackers, we don't know who it is yet. I mean, they don't want to create another crisis hot point in the world. North Korea has nuclear weapons. I don't think they want to jump the gun. I mean, what possible reason? They got enough on their plate. They got Middle East. They got Russia occupying Ukraine. They got lots of problems. Why would they suddenly want to pick a fight with North Korea, a nuclear-armed totalitarian state with a madman at the helm?
Well, they might not be doing so rightfully. Uh-huh. And they didn't jump because it took them 3 weeks to actually come out and say
something.
Well, you
say they don't have the evidence, so that's jumping. You know, you're implying it's similar to Iraq.
I'm saying the evidence they do have may be misleading.
that they've made available, but these are experts. I'm assuming, you know, that they understand some evidence can be misleading and that people do similar hacks and steal stuff once it's publicly available. So I'm assuming they have more than that, don't you? I just don't understand any motive for them pinpointing North Korea.
Okay, that leads you to the whole Occam's razor theory, which is
with no other thing, the simplest explanation is the best.
Right, meaning there was an insider who very well may be working with North Korea, or at least did at one point. And what I think is very interesting, you mentioned that North Korea said, well, we should work on this together.
I'm wondering why you think the Obama administration decided to recklessly identify North Korea as having attacked the United States to the level of a national security issue where they're going to retaliate if they didn't have to.
Oh, well, there may be a litany of other reasons for
such as wanting to... They don't have enough crises in the world to deal
with? No, they may want to play their hands with other countries, i.e. China, who actually controls North Korea's internet, by the way. They may have other reasons for wanting to do so. I'm not saying
it's a great international incident and escalate something to a national security issue when it's a hacker's attacking a movie studio. They want to turn that into an international incident.
It already is an international incident. So... Well,
no, it was not at the level of war.
Well, I don't think it's at the level of war now.
Well, if you target one of the biggest industries in a country's other than defense, entertainment is our biggest export, right?
I think it's one of them. Yes,
it's in the top five at least. It's a huge industry in the United States, and another government, another country, just attacked it. One of the biggest cyber attacks against a corporation in history. One of the most damaging in history, if not the most damaging corporate attacks. That's a massively big step forward in cyber warfare.
Yes.
You know, we're talking about around the world. Never has a country targeted a business of another country other than to steal secrets, you know, to destroy them and to put them out of business and to stop them from doing their business. That's a huge escalation in warfare on the internet. Huge.
Yeah, but I think there are some that would say, hey, this goes on all the time between companies, hacktivists and companies.
No, it does not.
I beg to differ.
Credit cards get stolen. People probe. People do things publicly attacking a company, taking them down, releasing all their data piece by piece, threatening to kill people if they continue their business as usual. That does not happen every day. The president getting involved because it's such a serious issue, that does not happen ever. Has never happened before with a cyber attack against a business. When Home Depot has their credit card stolen, the president does not hold a press conference threatening action against a sovereign state which has nuclear weapons. That's a hugely massive step. And you're telling me, well, we can use this to our advantage for some other reasons that you don't know about. That seems bizarre.
I wanted to go back for just a second. I think that you said, well, Sony was between a rock and a hard place, the theaters. You know, at the end of the day, Sony does have insurance, okay? And part of their logic in pulling the release is, and a lot of people say, well, why don't they release it on VOD? It's better for them to make nothing.
They're going to.
Yes, but at the time, it was better for them to make nothing. Now that their insurance company has likely come and said, okay, we know we're going to take a hit on this, but you better make some money on this. Okay. Uh-huh. They were doing the insurance play because it's better not to release it theatrically. It's better not to have any money at all come in when it comes to collecting insurance on this kind of disaster, really.
Who cares? I don't care about the $80 million there on the hold for this movie. But being released in two theaters and maybe video on demand does not make up for a wide release in commercial theaters with people perhaps going to see the movie. So, and no international release as of yet. So,
don't you think Sony should work with movie theater owners quietly and basically do a surprise release on like New Year's Day or some, you know, basically just announce?
You tend to want to let people know that the movie is available to see.
Yeah, but don't you think people would kind of know right away that it was available to see?
Yeah,
that rallying cry would work in their favor.
That's what I would have done, but you don't want to seem like, you know, but clearly it didn't work out that way.
Do you keep getting asked questions about it? As somebody who covers the industry for media outlets, do you get asked by like family and friends, hey, what do you think of the Sony hack?
Oh, sure, of course.
Oh my God, every conversation starts with, what do you think of Sony? I'm like, well, my TV, you know, it's 20 years old and it's still working.
Well, will this movie ever be on the National Film Registry?
I don't think the interview's making it.
It's now a culturally significant film, unquestionably.
That is true.
Yes.
Point. But, you know, it certainly can't make it. I think it has to actually be released for it to
No, because there are industrial films.
Good
yeah,
point.
So, no. Yeah. So we're talking, of course, about the National Film Registry. It's done by the Library of Congress, and every year they announce a new batch of films that get added to the registry. And this year's a good crop, an interesting one as always. As Spurling mentioned at the top of the show, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Big Lebowski, Saving Private Ryan, and Rosemary's Baby have all been added to the National Film Registry list.
And by the way, you can thank Michael because I had like a long sentence that included every single film in that was selected this year, except you told me to cut it back to like five.
Well, and there are others, movies that people will recognize, like the Gene Wilder version of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman, Down Argentine Way, which is not a great movie, but Carmen Miranda is in it, and Betty Grable became a star. It was one of the big movies that turned her into a pinup, just as World War II was coming into the fore, so that's why she was gracing the lockers of all the soldiers overseas. Any favorites of yours, Sperling? House of Wax, the 3D color film starring Vincent Price, the first 3D color film made and released by a big studio. That was back in 1953.
I think maybe Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Big Lebowski. Those are two of the big ones for me.
Well, what's interesting is...
The Power and the Glory, actually, I should say.
Well, that's an interesting one. It's a script by Preston Sturges, and it had a very complex structure and definitely influenced Citizen Kane by Orson Welles. And then there's State Fair, which is just a light film, but it's a great vehicle for Will Rogers and a pure piece of Americana that was directed by Henry King. And that lets you know these aren't supposed to be the best films of all time as such, but they're culturally significant films for one reason or another. So that's why beyond the big Hollywood movies like Rio Bravo and Please Don't Bury Me Alive, which is a film from 1976 that was a major pathbreaker in regional filmmaking. It was a bilingual film. It had a bicultural narrative, how it was made and distributed. In a way, it's the Latino sweetback as far as this movie and what it meant to the Latino community and how it was released around the country. So beyond all those studio movies and some films that got releases, you have silent films, you have documentaries, you have shorts, you have things that were shown in schools and churches like The Way of Peace, this movie, 18-minute short with puppets that was made for the American Lutheran Church by Frank Tashlin, a guy we know for making big cartoonish comedies. And so early in his career, he did this short for the American Lutheran Church, and you can find it online. We have a link in our show notes.
What are your big wins here, your big guy?
Well, that's not what I'll say. I will say I'm intrigued that the most recent film to make the list is 13 Lakes. It's a documentary by James Benning. It's from 2004, so this is the first year of eligibility. We'll have to wait a decade before the interview is eligible because you have to be been made for 10 years. And 13 Lakes is 13 10-minute shots. So it's a single shot for 10 minutes of 13 different lakes. You get one lake for 10 minutes, doesn't move, then there it is. Then boom, another lake. And then boom, another lake. It happens 13 times. I've never seen it. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm actually going to make a movie called 10 Buildings. I have an iPhone. I'm making a movie.
It's probably been made. And of course, Luxo Jr., that's an early Pixar short. And it stars the lamp that's now part of their logo. And it was directed by John Lasseter. Darn near everything by Pixar is probably going to be in there someday in some way, shape, or form. But that's a pretty iconic short for that studio and for, what it represents to them as their early success story and, how it became part of their iconography.
I don't think that the National Film Registry kind of has a ceremony where these, everybody shows up and, they...
No, we should throw a party, yeah.
But if they did, could you imagine if the interview got in, you could see James Franco and Seth Rogen there, like Stone, like, we're in the Library of Congress, dude.
Oh, I think they would show respect. It would be a very big deal for them.
Oh, I see what you're doing. I get it. Wait, you're trying to talk about Sony again, aren't you?
No. I want to move on to Big Deal and Big Whoop.
Oh, well, that's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? Sadly, actor Stephen Collins has admitted he had inappropriate contact with three underage girls. He insisted the incidents exposing himself, having one girl quote-unquote touch it, all occurred a long time ago, albeit over a long period of time between 1973 and 1994. He hasn't done or felt the desire to do anything for the last 20 years. That's what his agent said, too. He apologized to one of the girls years later, etc., etc. Collins was fired from one movie and reruns of his shows were yanked from TV, presumably briefly. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the people who are involved. It's sad and awful. And people will immediately say, oh, why are you giving him a pass and not Bill Cosby? Well, he hasn't gotten a pass. He's been fired from a number of jobs. His TV shows have disappeared, I assume, momentarily from the television. But it's ugly. It's sad. One hopes it's true that he has not done anything in the last 20 years and has managed to, not repeat these awful actions. And, what do you say? Will he ever work again? I don't know. It's ugly and it's sad.
I don't think Edward Snowden will ever work again, at okay. least not in cybersecurity.
Okay.
You know, a man who calls himself a retired naval officer and former secretary of the Kansas Department of Transportation has filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of the American people against Edward Snowden, in fact, and the creators of the highly acclaimed documentary Citizen 4. The suit claims Snowden broke his confidentiality agreement and that the director and producers of the film have aided and abetted his actions and will benefit financially from them. The filmmakers haven't commented yet on the suit. Big deal or big whoop?
It is the definition of a big whoop. Who cares? I mean, people can just file a lawsuit whenever they want, can't they? No matter how pointless and silly it is. And he's never going to be able to prove standing.
No. HBO apparently listens to Showbiz Sandbox.
Hey, HBO.
They have listened to Michael and I and now realize that giving out overnight ratings is a bad idea. Why? Because people are still watching their shows for a week after it airs. So HBO will wait 2 weeks. Yes, 2 weeks before giving out viewer info. So they listen to Michael and then add it a week just for, safe measure. This way they can include live viewers, those who watch encores, also known as repeats, by the way, DVR watchers, including those who watch the show within 7 days of broadcast, HBO to go, HBO on demand, any aliens on foreign planets, watching it. And this is a quote, a single airing is no longer representative of an HBO show's true audience size. And that was said by by HBO in a statement. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a very big deal. HBO leads, others follow. A lot of what they do is being imitated by other channels, by online sites, HBO to go, HBO on demand, the way that the shows they make, the number of shows they make, how many in a season, everything they do gets copied by everybody else. And I bet other people start copying this as well. I think it just makes sense. Why downplay how many people are watching your show? Wait till you got all the numbers and then make as big a splash as you can. To me, it just makes common sense.
Speaking of waiting a while, Richard Linklater is on top of the world. His tiny project Boyhood has proven a box office success, a critical darling, and a front runner for the Oscar. And now his big fat commercial hit School of Rock is headed to Broadway. The comedy about a struggling rock musician who becomes a substitute teacher will open on Broadway next December, with rock songs being joined by some new music from this kind of young upstart Andrew Lloyd Webber, and an adaptation penned by, sounds like a hack, Julian Fellows of Downton Abbey fame. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. Movie gets turned into musical. It happens every day. But Andrew Lloyd Webber and Julian Fellows,
exactly,
who could be less in sync with School of Rock. Andrew Lloyd Webber knows nothing about rock. Julian Fellows knows nothing about America. They just seem like awful, awful people to be involved with this musical.
Well, why?
And I'm sure it'll be a big success.
Why do you need to know something?
They just seem completely out of touch with the material. They seem utterly. I could see Nick Hornby doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Nick Hornby would make sense. I don't mean British people can't do it, but Nick Hornby, somebody with a vague idea of America, not Julian Fellows and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Or the importance of rock music and certain rock music, yes.
Yeah, a bizarre cast of people to be involved in this musical.
Well, who knows? Maybe Julian Fellows is like a closet, Jimi
Absolutely.
Hendrix fan.
Who knows? Yeah. Well, if I liked Downton Abbey better, maybe I'd be more excited.
Ooh, okay. Well, the big trend in pop music is a surprise release of an album. Superstar Beyoncé caught everyone by surprise when she released a new album and videos for each song of her latest record all at once, with no one even suspecting she had an album ready. How is it that she can do that and nothing leaks and all of Sony's emails are out on the internet now? I don't get it. But anyway, that became all the rage, this whole blitzkrieg of a surprise album release. But now Madonna is finding out the release of a new album can surprise even the artist. She's been working on a new album and suddenly multiple demos were bootlegged and posted online, spreading faster than a virus. See what we did there, Michael?
I did.
Madonna asked her fans not to listen to them since they were unfinished. offered the new album for pre-sale and made 6 tracks available immediately to counter the leak. Quote unquote, "Thank you for not listening," she wrote on Instagram, because that's how all people should like address their fans, Instagram. She also thanked them for their loyalty. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. Songs leak from an album. It's the world we live in. But I think it's a big deal in the sense that you have to be proactive and be smart. And I think she has been. She said, all right, it's out there. What do I do now? Instead of just bemoaning that fact, she took a proactive step and did something positive, tried to make her fans feel loyal to her and rally to her and make, you know, want to support her rather than, you know, abandoning the project. Who am I thinking of there? Sony, you know. So I think she did a smart thing, did it the right way. But you talk about how did Beyonce manage to keep it secret? I know you're joking a little bit, but two things. Of course, one, it's obviously very easy to keep 19 tracks of music and 20 videos a secret rather than an entire business company. But the other thing is I actually know people who were involved in that album at some level. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know until actually the album came released because they were not allowed to tell anyone. I absolutely did not know in advance, but I know people editing on some of the videos, they, to do business with some of these superstars who want to keep their projects under wraps, they have taken new steps, like in their business, created a sealed room that nobody can enter without a sealed, you know, a key. You know, you can't just walk in there. You have to be let in there and then let out again. And it's a sealed room and it's cut off from the rest of the company. It does not have internet access. And that's where they do the editing to secure it as much as possible with inside their company. So, I mean, they go to extreme steps to isolate that music and those videos and to keep them separate from the internet, keep them separate from other people on staff, you know, on all that sort of stuff. They go into high security mode and it's a big, big, Megillah to do all that. It ain't easy, you know, so it's a pretty complicated. When you think about what they do just to keep that secret, imagine trying to do that for an entire company.
We should try in some way work the word Megillah into the headline of this show. But, you know, as you were mentioning all this, it dawned on me, I now know who did the Sony hack.
Who?
I figured it out. It's Bill Cosby.
He's to take attention away from what happened to him?
Yeah, we haven't talked about that in ages. Well, granted, we talked about it last week, but still, you know, it's we mentioned it in passing as opposed to it being our lead story.
Well, suddenly, another woman came forward. She's a former girlfriend of Sammy Davis Jr. She says he assaulted her in the early 70s. It was not like the other scenarios that were typically described, which makes me believe it even more, frankly, because she didn't mimic what other people were saying. She didn't say he drugged her, put a drug in her drink, or said, oh, take this pill and lie to her about what it was. He just assaulted her in a hotel room, and she was too embarrassed and ashamed to tell Sammy Davis Jr. about it. And frankly, it's just, you know, once you're up to the 18th, 19th, how many, you know, do you need 20 women before you start to believe him? I mean, it just becomes very hard not to think that he's been a serial rapist for many, many years. It's just awful and sad.
Well, I do think that the media began to tone it down a bit after the whole Sony incident because they realized, well, gee, we're just taking all of these people at their face value. Where is the trial? Like, if they're going to come out and say this stuff, at least, you know, prove it in some way. And
they would love to. They tried. They did. And he paid and he settled and settled out of court rather than go to trial. And other women have said, I'll keep saying this and please sue me because I would love to go to court. So I don't think the women are the case. They're, when someone comes forward and publicly identifies themselves and says it, and other people start to step forward, and these are public figures, a fair number of them. So, you know, we've got 2 supermodels and other people who are not. We've got lawyers. We've got top officials at universities that he's affiliated with. These are not just, you know, fly-by-night people trying to gain some attention at the National Enquirer. These are serious people going to serious outlets and telling their story. It should be taken seriously, especially when they are identifying themselves. So I don't think the media backed off it. I think it's just we all now know it's true. These stories have surfaced before, but now they've gained a snowball effect. You know, they've become bigger and bigger to where it could not be ignored anymore. Everybody talked about it, and there's really nothing new to say unless some person comes forward who's so well known it shocks us again into paying attention. The next step will be when he tries to do something new, like maybe Netflix tries to release the concert film or somebody does something, then it will become an issue again. But I think, you know, after 2-3 weeks of talking about it, there's just not that much more to say.
Although we said the same thing about Sony.
Did we?
That after 2-3 weeks of talking about it, why are we still talking about it? And yet the story keeps going.
It escalated into a national security issue. They threatened to bomb movie theaters.
Okay. Well,
I don't think there's any reason why we're talking about it. It's clear.
How about that? You got a bonus big deal, big whoop story in there.
There you go.
But that kind of wraps up that segment, moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, This story, the reason we're talking about this story is because it is Christmas week. Now, this is the kind of Christmas news you should expect on Christmas week. None of this Sony hacking stuff, okay? But here we have a story that we've talked about it before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's about Irving Azoff, who's this music industry heavyweight, you know, kind of Ticketmaster, and he's run record companies and all that. He now has this new firm called Global Music Rights.
It's like ASCAP or BMI.
Right. So he's basically trying to take them on.
Well, and create his own business.
Right.
And he's got a lot of clients, the Eagles, Pharrell Williams, John Lennon, and many others.
Right. And basically what a performance rights organization does is you play something on the radio, you have to pay I'm trying to remember, okay, because it's a part of copyright law.
Well, don't get technical. It's not important. You got to pay some money to people who handle it for their songwriters.
Right. Songwriters. That's the lyricist and publisher. 50-50. Yeah. That's performance rights. Mechanical rights is when you have a CD and you're making a CD of the album or of a song. Well, Irving Azoff is going after YouTube and Google saying, hey, you don't have the rights to some of these songs, 20,000 songs you don't have the rights to. So you're going to have to pull them down. And Google is saying, one, we do still have the rights because when we purchased the license, we purchased it either from ASCAP or BMI, those songs were a part of it. So until our license expires, those songs remain a part of it. But if you'd like us to pull them down, you need to identify which songs, which videos, and which URLs.
He mean illegal uses of the song?
No, he's talking about any use.
Oh, okay.
Because really, he's going after them because YouTube came out and said, we're going to have a music streaming service. That's really what he's saying. Now that you're getting paid, we want to be paid. And you don't have the rights to this. YouTube is saying, yeah, actually, we kind of do have the rights, at least for a short period of time here until our license expires. That's number one. Number two, let's talk about how you need to let us know. The law says you need to let us know what URLs have infringing material on them, okay? Because we're not going to go find them for you. What Azoff's team, legal team, is saying is, well, hey, wait a second. Don't you have this thing like Content ID, as YouTube calls it, so that you can fingerprint the music and then certain videos can actually earn money if they have copyrighted material on them. So you can actually monetize copyrighted material. You have that. So why can't you identify copyrighted material and instead of monetizing it, pull it down? And so it's going back and forth and back and forth. And so the only update to this news story is really the fact that they've gone back and forth a few more times.
And they're exchanging letters. The lawyers are mocking each other in public, saying, well, you failed to remember.
Right.
And things like that.
I mean, literally, this is in public. They're actually talking to the Hollywood Reporter and trade outlets and the Wall Street Journal saying, well, he said and she said. And what's interesting is, in a way, YouTube is right. YouTube is saying, here is the law. The law is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. We are adhering to the law, period. If you want us to pull stuff down, we will, but you have to identify it. And for 20,000 songs, what Irving Azoff and his company are saying is, well, wait a second, there's millions and millions of hours of footage and millions of videos, and we can't do that. It's like a whack-a-mole, where there's no way we can do that. It would take us years and years and years to do that. And YouTube said, exactly. Meaning, yeah, we can't do it either.
Well, more to the point is that streaming is the way of the future. That's what everybody thinks. There's money to be made, they believe. It may be made at the beginning when you license the music, and therefore the artists themselves don't make a big cut. You know, maybe the labels make the big money or the publishers make the big money, but there is a big pile of money to be had. And if YouTube enters that streaming music world, and they are, well, they want a cut of the pie.
It's kind of like people fighting over DVD royalties like a few years back when everybody knew, hey, it's going to be streaming. Forget DVD royalties. Start talking about streaming royalties. Guess what? Irving Azoff is no dummy. He knows streaming is where it's at.
Well, we'll have to see what happens next. Presumably, it will happen when the streaming service goes live.
I think it's live for some people, actually.
Oh, well, then maybe now there'll be even more an escalation of words.
We'll see. It'll probably happen after the new year.
Okay.
So, well, somebody who did not make it to the new year, unfortunately, is Joe Cocker, who passed away at the age of 70.
Which is amazing in and of itself.
This
guy lived hard.
Oh,
I mean, I know he was sober and clean for many years, I believe. But boy, in the 60s and 70s, he was legendary for his excess in cocaine and alcohol and drug. I mean, he did it all, baby. They had the traveling road show, concert stage, living it up, groupies, sex, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, he was living the life hard. And the idea that he would make it to 70, that's a beautiful thing. That's what rehab can be, a lovely thing.
So he's known for his rendition of With a Little Help from My Friends, the Beatles song.
Perhaps the greatest cover of all time.
That's true.
Is there a better cover of any song? I mean, it's a great song to begin with, but he made that song so unbelievably soulful and significant in a way it really wasn't before. It's just one of many great tracks on Sgt. Pepper, but he turned what was sort of an odd little ditty intro into just this incredibly moving, soulful. It was just a revelation.
I was shocked, actually, that he was the singer behind it, or that it wasn't the theme song to that Winnie Cooper show.
The Wonder Years.
That was
you were shocked what?
That it wasn't just the theme song to The Wonder Years.
Oh gosh.
That joke is a lot funnier when I can actually remember the name of the show as I'm saying it.
Okay. He also sang Up Where We Belong, which was his biggest hit. That was the Oscar-winning song from An Officer and a Gentleman, a movie I took my mom to and which she was shocked by. There are sex scenes and you don't realize it until you take your mom to the movie. And then he also, of course, sang You Are So Beautiful, a lovely cover. So he did a lot of great covers, had some big original hits. Clearly, his heyday was in the 60s and early 70s when he was just Mad Dogs and Englishmen touring the country with everybody, living it up. But a classic soul singer.
Well, and, you know, I heard one music critic on the air, I think it was on NPR, talking about, or the BBC, talking about how Joe Cocker would really get inside the music, man. You know, like his show at Woodstock, he was like...
Is that a stoner talking?
Totally. I don't know why all of a sudden this music critic is a stoner. But he was talking about how he would get inside the music and, like, you know, it's like the audience wasn't even there. Like he was singing it for himself. I'm like, do you realize? Yeah, at Woodstock, he probably doesn't even remember Woodstock, okay?
But there was an audience. Yeah.
So, yeah, he was inside the song. He could have been anywhere. It didn't matter where he was. But, like, you know, he kind of overlooked the fact that, yeah, Joe Cocker was probably on another planet when he was singing that song at Woodstock.
Yeah, so he's a cool guy, a great live act. Not a lot of great albums to his credit, but, you know, a very distinctive voice with some wonderful tracks to his credit.
Yes. We do have one very brief email that I want to get into, at least in part. We've talked about this already, this subject, but James Gardner, a listener from Australia, who we've referenced previously, who's written to the show previously, longtime listener, he's writing about the effect it will have on people working in the entertainment business, but on the IT side, the cyber side, if you will. Michael, do you want to read at least a portion of this?
What portion do you want me to read? Why don't you read it?
Okay, he writes, "Hi guys, I am dumbfounded by the Sony reactions to recent events. What happened to the typical Hollywood cliche? The U.S. does not negotiate with terrorists," he asks. "My main concern," and this is really the part that I wanted to highlight here, is that this now sets a precedent for terrorists. Of course, we've all been saying that, but the most cost-effective in money and human lives is to do cyber attacks if you go by recent events. The success of this attack will bring billions into this terrible hidden war. As an IT person, I know it has been raging away, hidden from public mindshare, but now Sony has shown how attacking high-profile companies of countries you're trying to attack can have such devastating and high-profile effect. And that's what terrorism is about, a small attack that affects as many people and people's lives as possible." And I'd, you know, in that regard, I kind of agree. All I can see from this is that many of the computer systems I run for my company will be seen as tools for these skirmishes going forward. And the world industry as a whole will be paying billions, if not trillions, to harden their security against this massive tidal wave of investment coming for the cyber cold war. Of course, Michael, you don't think that any of that investment will be any good, but
that's not true at all. It's a massive change in mindset for how the internet works and how companies behave and how people behave. And I think the people who are going to profit most are the companies that provide new security. And, you know, we're going to have a Maginot line of security for your company, and then someone will get around it and they'll sell you something else to defend against that.
Right. And that came from James Gardner, who wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
And a quick correction. Thanks for writing in, by the way, James. A quick correction. One of our viewers was catching up on shows, so it's a correction for a show from a couple weeks ago. They need to catch up quick. It's about Hugh Jackman in The River. We said, I think, that this was his first straight play on Broadway. It was probably me. I don't remember. But this show is not his first straight play on Broadway. He also did A Steady Rain back in 2009 with Daniel Craig.
Didn't he also do Oklahoma? I thought he was doing...
He did, but that's a musical. Oh, yeah, Oklahoma is where he became a star in London. He didn't do it on Broadway, I don't believe.
I don't know why I thought straight play. Like, well, he did The Boy from Oz, so.
That's certainly not a straight play.
Exactly.
But I saw him in London, in Oklahoma, actually. So there you go. That was very exciting. Star was born.
Literally. I mean, he was doing Oklahoma when this guy, Bryan Singer, called and said, hey, I hear you might be pretty good for this little movie I'm doing called The X-Men. I don't know when Bryan Singer became Bill Clinton.
That's all right. So if Hugh Jackman wants to write in and thank us for that, what does he do?
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, any place they give away podcasts or aggregate podcasts. That's where we can be found. Our show is free, so please subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us and links to follow us on Twitter. At showbizsandbox is our username there. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Showbizsandbox.com is also where you'll find all those ways to contact us. So again, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's istandwithmadonna.com. I'm not going to listen to those downloaded demos that they put out there. I'm going to respect her. I'm going to wait for the album proper.com.
Well, I respect that it wasn't anything having to do with the Sony leak, but you may be trying to avoid being hacked by North Korea.
That's right.
You know,
it's actually, you can find me at unapologeticbitch.com. That's the name of one of her songs.
Leave it to Madonna.
It's either that or Mr. Cranky Pants.
And for that reference, go back a few shows. But, you know, if you really want to dig up some of Michael's writing and coverage of the entertainment industry, you might head on over to the Huffington Post, or you could even go to michaelgiltz.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. There's no show next week. In fact, we're not going to have another show until next year. So until... Yeah, that's right, when you think about it. So until next year, play nice.